Rock Monster, My Life with Joe Walsh is an honest account of one woman's life-changing experience in a relationship with rock legend Joe Walsh. At once envious, glamorous, debauched and disturbing, it's her long and winding journey from life in the fast lane to sobriety and redemption. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the US author of Rock Monster, Kirsten Casey. Kirsten, good morning to you.
Hey, good morning. How you doing?
I'm very well, thank you, on this lovely Friday afternoon. Rockstar life sounds glamorous, fun. You're out there pushing the boundaries. Your book sort of debunks that myth in rather a large way. You were with Joe Walsh, of course, member of the Eagles and solo artist as well, during what's described as his darkest years in the press notes.
Yeah, I would say that they were definitely Joe's darkest years as far as the substance abuse and addiction. You know, Joe did lose a daughter in a car accident, so that would obviously be the darkest years for anyone. But there was a big chunk of his life that a lot of his fans don't know much about. Obviously, he doesn't talk too much in detail about it, and I just happen to have the distinction of being his partner during that time. So, they were some dark years. They were also some super glamorous and fun years. It was a real roller coaster up and down.
How did you guys get to meet up? Because obviously, where and when did you meet Joe?
We met in Austin, Texas, where I live, in May of 1988. A girlfriend of mine that I was stripping with in a club here in Austin was dating his bass player sort of casually. They had met months before, and she would travel around the country to visit him, and then the guys came through town to play a gig, and she asked me for a ride to the hotel one night after work. And she may have told me the guy's name, but Joe Walsh wouldn't have meant anything to me. I wasn't that much into classic rock. I was 20 years old. You know, I was more into new wave and punk, and I knew a little classic rock. I knew his music, but I didn't know his name. So I just went to meet, I went upstairs with her to meet him just to be polite. I just wanted to go home and go to bed. And so 15 minutes later, I was in love with the guy, and I stayed till 8 a.m. And then we eventually, a few months later, started dating pretty seriously.
And was he a sort of a rock and roll wild man? Was he a whirlwind, or did you fall for this sort of introspective artist? What were your first impressions then?
Do you know, my first impressions of him, I was taken aback more by how silly and boyish he was, and like not outrageous. Like, he wasn't chainsawing the room to bits that night. He was just drawing on the TV and showing me his moonwalk, which was terrible, by the way. And I just thought he was adorable. I thought he was so sweet and silly. And, you know, I really liked that in a guy because I was kind of serious and driven. And he was, it was just really silly. And the fact that he was kind of a rock star and had like no ego. I mean, he just wasn't being boisterous or self-centered in any way. He was just trying to impress me in these little silly ways, and it was adorable, and it worked.
When you decided to start dating seriously a couple of months after you'd first met him, I mean, did you move from Austin, Texas to the West Coast? I mean, how did it physically work itself out in terms of you know leaving your job and going to live with him?
Yeah, so, that night I fell in love with him, and then the next day I went to see his concert, and that's when I realized how famous he was. I really had no idea, and I thought, oh, God, he's never going to call me. He's an actual rock star, and I was so depressed because I thought, you know, we're meant to be together. I thought this was the man I meant to marry. But apparently he felt something, too, and he called me, and so we talked on the phone some, and then a couple months later he started flying me around to see him. And just within a few months, you know, we were fully on in love, and I started traveling a lot with him for the next couple of years, but I always had my home base in Austin. And then after a couple of years, that got to be really, you know, challenging. And so one day he said, let's buy a house and move you in. So I moved in with him in L.A., and I quit work. And that is, of course, when the drugs for me got out of control, because instead of being around them, you know, 2 or 3 weeks a month, they were there every day. And since I wasn't working, I could really indulge as if I were a rock star in my own right, which I wasn't. And so that's when I started to really spiral.
I did
love living in L.A., yeah.
Yeah, I mean, when you say the drugs start kicking in, are we talking about, you know, the choice of drugs of the late 80s, 90s? Are we talking cocaine? Are we talking LSD? What were we looking at here, Kirsten?
Well, you know, my drug of choice was pretty much what you got. But there was mostly cocaine. That was, you know, we were both alcoholics already. I was 20, he was 40, and, you know, we both were alcoholics already, but he'd been using coke for at least 20 years by then. I had had a brief stint with meth before I met him, lasted less than 6 months, and I had quit hard drugs. You know, I did a lot of mushrooms and acid and the kind of stuff I didn't think you could get addicted to. But once I got with Joe, I eventually started using coke and snorting coke. Once I moved in with him, I was doing so much, I actually blew out my septum, and I had a hole in my septum, and so I kind of used that as an excuse to start smoking crack, thinking, well, I gotta, you know, I have to preserve what's left of my nose. And so that was my rationalization for smoking crack, which Joe did not approve of. He also didn't really know how to stop me. I mean, he loved me, and he couldn't quit coke at the time, and so it was really hard to try to tell me to quit crack. But I really spiraled at that point. And we were also using, you know, ecstasy and mushrooms and acid and some pot and, you know, just basically a lot of drugs a lot of the time.
I mean, how were you able to perform? How was Joe able to perform and go out on the road? When you went on the road with him, were you able to keep it under wraps, or were you just sort of slumped in the back of the tour bus or the private plane, or, you know, in the back room? How did it work?
Slumped in the back of a tour bus, that definitely describes some of the time. I was the kind of person who, once I did one line, I was off and running for the next two or three days until it was all out. Joe was more of a daily user, and then he would go on a binge with me once a week, too. He, you know, he's one of those guys who is just a really high-performing addict. You know, he could get on stage and just knock it out of the park, even if he'd been up for a couple of days. Although I will say there are times when if you see him on Letterman in those years, like 89, 90, 91, 92, you know, those were the years that we were really spiraling, in 93, you will notice, you know, he looks a little different. You know, he's not quite as on point. But he could go on stage sometimes and knock it out of the park, whereas, you know, there was no way I would have been able to work in that condition. And so on the road, you know, things would get out of hand. When we left the country, we didn't usually have access to coke. So actually, when we'd go to Japan or Australia, sometimes those were good. We would drink a lot.
Yeah.
But at least we'd have a little bit of a break from coke.
Right. Sort of a normality thing. But as you said before, you said that you were both alcoholics when you moved in together. I mean, although I use the term very sort of loosely, did you realize you're alcoholics at that point? Were you just functioning or in denial? And I suppose the thing is, if you are in a situation where everybody is high and doing stuff and has the time and the money to do various substances, I don't suppose it sort of seems out of the ordinary. You get that sort of warped mindset.
Oh yeah, I mean that was really the heart of the of my denial. It was so glamorous, and everyone around me was doing it. You know, how could I? This can't be a problem. It's not like I'm homeless. You know, that's what I kept thinking. Like, it's, you know, in this lifestyle, this is normal. This is, and everyone around me was doing it, and they were all so successful. And since I didn't have to work, and I was going to marry Joe, you know, we were engaged. It just, I had all these rationalizations, and as far as the term alcoholic, we didn't really use that word. You know, like Joe went to rehab briefly when we were together. And I think he was aware that he was a coke addict, but neither of us used the term alcoholic. And in my mind, my struggle was just that I needed to moderate better. I needed to learn how to do coke on the weekends, you know, just be like a social cocaine user or a social crackhead. I didn't really use the word alcoholic until he got sober in 94, and then I quit drugs because he had quit drugs. But I continued drinking, and I started asking him, you know, tell me about this recovery business, and what are these meetings like, and what was rehab like, and do you think I'm an alcoholic, you know? And he kept saying, you know, you got to answer that for yourself. And I, the information, you know, there was no internet then, and the information that we have now, you know, we knew more about coke in the 80s, but it was very easy to slip into denial. And I worked in bars. Even after we broke up, I went back to the strip clubs. And so, you know, there was a lot of drinking. So, again, it was normalized. And that's part of the story. It's like you can find a lot of rationalizations if you're looking for them. I finally realized I was an alcoholic a couple years before I quit drinking. And I didn't think there was any help for me, and so I just decided to drink myself to death. That was, you know, once I realized I was an alcoholic, I thought, well, that's it for me. I'm just going to drink myself to death.
And what was the, I mean, Joe got sober in 94 and got off everything, and you were still using and drinking. Was this, you know, was that one of the reasons that you think that you guys split up? Because, you know, there's nothing more boring for somebody who's using than somebody who's straight, and probably vice versa.
Yeah, I would say that's the exact reason that it was over. You know, we really loved each other. The first time we broke up in 93 was just because we were fighting nonstop, and we were getting, you know, a little violent with each other. We broke up for 6 months and then got back together, and the next day, just coincidentally, the Eagles called him that night and convinced him to go to rehab the next day. So, you know, we were suddenly a couple again, but I was continuing to drink, and he was just getting more and more successful and more sober and healthy. So all we did for the next year was drift apart. I mean, I think we would have broken up within a matter of months, but he just couldn't bring himself to hurt me. Plus, I think he saw how fragile I was. You know, alcoholics don't really handle rejection or trauma all that well. He was probably afraid if he broke up with me officially sooner that it would send me off the deep end, and he was probably right. So he really turned his life around, and I think the Eagles getting him into rehab probably saved his life. But I just spiraled. Yeah,
I mean, when he turned his life around, and of course we had the famous Hell Freezes Over tour, which was a massive commercial success. Were you guys weren't together at that point? You'd split by then, had you? Or were you still together?
Well, that actually took place during the time that we were slowly drifting apart. So I was at a number of those shows. Yeah, I don't remember a lot of them because I was drinking. I was sneaking it, you know, sneaking drinks and sneaking it backstage. But, yeah, it was really interesting. It was really wonderful to see him go from some of the smaller shows that he'd been doing and low record sales in those 5-6 years we had been together to this massive success, and that, you know, that band is just so on point. And, you know, he was really nervous at first. I think he had lost a lot of self-esteem and belief in himself, but then as the tour went on, he just got so much more confident, you know, and he got really back into his groove. And he started inviting me to fewer and fewer shows. And I think by, you know, within about 9 or 10 months, I was not even seeing him but once a month or every other month. I think, you know, he was a little embarrassed to have me on the road because I was kind of a mess, and he was doing so well.
I was going to say, what was the rest of the band's reaction when they got back, you know, when they got Joe back in and you came around being, should we say, extroverted and, you know, and unique?
Mm-hmm. Well, to tell you the truth, that's kind of funny. The band pretty quickly started distancing themselves from each other almost. You know, as long as they'd been together, I think there was a lot of love there. The way Joe described it, you know, it's a lot like brothers who fight a lot. You know, they love each other, but they can't always be in the same room together. So pretty quickly after the tour started, I mean, at some of the first shows I went to, I noticed that the guys didn't socialize. They didn't even go in the same transport vans to the concerts. And one time they all got on the elevator sort of accidentally at once to head to the show, and none of them even talked to each other, said hello, or looked at each other. there was a lot of tension, and, you know, a lot of egos in that band. And in fact, Joe used to call them the Egos instead of the Eagles behind their back.
The Egos.
The Egos. That was our little joke. When I was with him on the road with the Eagles, generally I was pretty well behaved on the way to the show, and I'd drink a little maybe behind the show. I'd sneak a little in my purse. But then once I got back to the hotel with Joe in private, that's when I would start drinking. I never wanted to make him look bad in front of the band, but honestly, they weren't together all that often unless they were on stage.
And what's it like being backstage, you know, on a major concert tour like that? I mean, who were the people that you came across that you can remember and that you really thought, wow, that's, you know, that made you starstruck while you were there?
I'll tell you, you know, backstage at the Eagles, I didn't always see a lot of, they were pretty careful about keeping the mayhem from backstage, because they were so serious and, you know, family men and stuff, but I wasn't at a lot of those shows. But earlier in Joe's career, like when he was with Ringo, touring with Ringo Starr, And any shows that he did in L.A., like at the Greek Theater especially, it was just like a celebrity fest. You know, you never knew who you're going to run into back there. Jack Nicholson frequently, you know, like one time Jack at the Greek Theater during one of Ringo's All-Star Band Tour shows, he just burst into our dressing room, went into the bathroom, did a couple big lines of coke without closing the door, and then just ran back out again. You know, you just never knew who was going to show up and what was going to happen. So, you know, like Bonnie Raitt was back there, Gary Busey, you know, actors and musicians of all types. Like, I'm trying to think of who was some of the more... Oh, John Candy one night, and he was one of my favorites. You know, he just... we hung out all night. He's one of the sweetest guys ever. Steven Tyler was back there one time.
Steve, yeah, we've got Steve Tyler's coming to Spain this year, so we're looking forward to seeing him play as well. I'm just thinking that, you know, the wonderful image of Jack Nicholson backstage at a Joe Walsh and Ringo Starr gig in L.A., what could possibly go wrong?
Musicians in the world, right? And so all the guys in the band, because Ringo's All-Star Tour was just like nine famous musicians in their own right, you know, Dr. John and Clarence Clemens from the E Street Band and Billy Preston, and so they all had their own little dressing rooms, but Ringo's this huge star, and then Jack Nicholson is backstage kind of acting like he owns the place, and it's really funny because he's got this presence, and people just sort of cut a path from him, and if he wants to walk into your dressing room, he's going to walk into your dressing room, and he's not going to knock. And once he's there, like, he went and he did some coke, then he left, and then he came right back with, like, a little gaggle of fans and Harry D. Stanton, and then they came in the dressing room. We had two chairs. They took our chairs. The fans sat on the floor, and I'm standing there in the corner going, what just happened here? This is dressing room, and Jack Nicholson just took it over. And, you know, what are you going to say to the guy? Get out? I just kind of stood there with my jaw dropped. It was really funny.
Life is stranger than fiction, as the saying goes. When did you decide then? You and Joe drifted apart because, if you like, you're living different lifestyles. You know, he's got clean and sober, and you are facing your own demons. When did you decide then that you had to address your problems?
Well, I would say at the last minute. That's when I decided. When Joe and I made that second final split, it was over the phone. I had moved to Las Vegas, and we were talking about me moving back in with him in L.A., although it just never happened because we had drifted apart. So one day we're on the phone, and you know, it was time, and he finally just said, you know, it's over. And it was just really hard, and he felt so bad. He said, I'll come see you tomorrow. And he flew up to Vegas, and we just spent the day together sort of holding hands and walking around and just saying goodbye in our own way, and then he got in a cab and drove back to the airport. And when he drove off, I felt this thud that was just so profound and devastating, because I'd wrapped my entire life and identity up in this guy for six straight years, for six of the past 7 years, and I didn't even know who I was anymore. All my ambition, all my goals of being a writer, and I had lived in his shadow, so I felt so empty all of a sudden, like I didn't even exist, and I just thought, within the next 30 seconds, I thought, I don't want to be here anymore. So I spent the next 2 years trying to drink myself to death, and I came very, very close. And then in April of 97, I got so sick I couldn't move, I couldn't get out of bed. I thought actually I might die that day. I'd been in and out of the hospital already. You know, I was bloated and yellow, and my organs were shutting down. I was in really bad shape. And I'd lay there just sort of waiting for it to happen. And then I started thinking, really, I had nothing else I could do. I was laying there unable to move or talk. So I started really thinking about what I was doing. Like, I could die today, and this is what I've been after. And then it hit me that this is not how I meant to go. You know, this is not, I thought, suicide is a cop-out, and I've known it all along. And so now I gotta try a different way. And I had a friend at a strip club I was working at, a number of girlfriends actually, who were clean and sober. And I reached out to one of them, and I really thought I was going to do these stupid 12 steps of hers, prove they didn't work, and then I could off myself with a clear conscience. And what happened was they worked. So I got sober, and I haven't had a drink since, and that was 21 years ago.
Congratulations on that. That's an incredible story. What was it like then when you came down to sit and write the book? And you know, they all say, oh, if you can remember it, you weren't really there. But, I mean, how difficult was it to sit with a blank sheet of paper? Or did you keep a diary or a journal whilst you were there? Because people have said this is a very intimate, to put it mildly. I mean, you don't hold back on the sex and the drugs and the rock and roll here.
Yeah. You know, I think my intent was probably not to reveal quite so much, but I have to say I have a great agent and editor, and they really liked my book and they wanted to know more about my childhood. They really encouraged me to write more about some of the childhood experiences that led me to be a person who would so quickly fall into addiction, because that was one thread I really wanted to stress in the book, was that addicts aren't created out of a vacuum. You know, childhood trauma is a known factor, and possibly in every case. And I was a very sensitive child, and so I wrote a lot about my childhood that I probably hadn't initially intended to, but you can't write about how you become an alcoholic if you're not going to write about your childhood. You just can't. And then I wanted to write about, you know, what led me to the depth of my addiction, and part of it was the glamorous life was like a veil where I couldn't really see what was happening. It was it sort of deluded me. And I think I also wanted to include a thread about sexuality, because my journey from dependency, childhood trauma, leading me to a life of dependency, to eventually standing on my own two feet and being an empowered person, there was this thread of my sexuality that, as a woman, is not always appreciated or embraced or comfortably talked about in our society. I mean, you're in Europe, I'm in America, and we're still quite puritanical here. And I felt like what made my story a little different, because there's a lot of addiction memoirs out there, and I didn't want to write mine until I had something new to offer or something personal that, you know, some new information to add to the collective intelligence. And I think female sexuality is something, a conversation we need to start having in this country. Because to me, it was about self-expression. And so in our relationship, my dependency expressed itself in substance abuse and in a dependency or codependency on my partner, and also in a certain level of submission sexually that was not authentic to me. I did not feel comfortable expressing my natural authentic sexuality in that relationship. And this is not an uncommon experience for women, and it is not one that's talked about much. And so I felt like it was important to share some of those details. And it wasn't easy, but I do have a strong emotional recall. I think I did keep journals. I kept a lot of journals. And I have a ton of pictures, you know, that jogged my memory. But when a person with a certain level of hypersensitivity, you know, there's about 20% of the population that have a lot of hypersensitivity, the nervous system. We also tend to have a strong emotional recall. And so I didn't write about anything that I didn't remember well, because I wanted my book to be as honest as is possible to write. And so it was revealing, and I took a risk, and I stand by it, but I don't know if I was quite prepared. I just wrote the book, and then it came out, and I thought, my gosh, everything I wrote is now in the public eye. I still haven't quite, it's very surreal right now to have my personal story out there. Like, I did this, but I just kind of went, wow. I did put out a lot of personal information. I hope it helps somebody.
Did Joe know you were going to write this book, and have you heard anything from him since?
You know, he and I stayed friends for a long time. We'd weave in and out of each other's lives, and we talked on the phone and saw each other in person and emailed up until 7 years ago, something like that. And I decided to write the book about 5 years ago, and I did try to reach out to him, but he had suddenly become very hard to reach, and so I quit trying, and I finished the book, and then I tried one more time, and I couldn't reach him, so I don't know if he's read it. I assume he has. I hope he enjoys it, but I don't know.
And what do you hope that people will take out of it? I mean, is it a story of redemption? Is it a story about how close you came and how you came back, and but also very much a snapshot of a rock and roll lifestyle at that time, the late 80s to the early 90s?
You know, that's such a good question. I really do feel like there's a few themes there that I want to get across. One of them, I would say, is about the rock and roll lifestyle. Like, you know, there's no good is ever really going to come of putting celebrities on a pedestal, because they're just as human and fallible as the rest of us, you know? And if we do that, we enable that wild behavior, which is not good for them, you know, or the hotel rooms that they stay in. I also think it's important to have a conversation about, you know, parenting styles. I think that things have changed over the last 100, 200 years, but there's a difference between discipline and criticism, and childhood trauma is a factor in addiction, and we need to start looking at how we raise our kids. I also, more than anything, wanted to get across that I am not a victim. I made choices, or refused to make choices, that I needed to make, and I paved my way to that darkness, to that place I ended up, because I refused to take accountability for my life, and I could have done so at any time. It was terrifying and scary, and I didn't know how to do it, but I made the easier choice of just attaching myself to someone else and letting him lead me around. And even though dependency expresses in many, many ways, it will manifest in many ways, empowerment comes from one place. And like, only I could decide to become willing to change my life. And then as soon as I did, the day I did, help started coming to me from everywhere, from every direction. It still blows my mind. It was all about just deciding, I'm going to try harder. I'm going to try to make something of myself. I'm going to speak up. I'm going to ask for help. You know what I mean? And so I think it was really important for me to get across that I was not a victim. You know, I was confused, and your parents are responsible for taking care of you, but for most of us, you know, we didn't get everything we needed, and the only person we can rely on at that point is ourselves, and people are always going to treat you the way you treat yourself, and I wasn't treating myself very good, so I can't blame anyone else for treating me the way I was teaching them how to treat me, you know what I mean? I hope that it would be a little inspiring in that way.
The book is called Rock Monster, My Life with Joe Walsh. It's out now on Rare Bird Books. Kirsten, if people want to find out some more information about you or the book, or want to find you online, do you do the Twitter thing? Do you on social media? Is there a website?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, thanks for asking. My website recently up is KristenCaseyAuthor.com, and that's Kristen with an I-N. And then I'm on Twitter and Facebook, and my handle is Ms. Kristen Casey, so that's MS Kristen Casey, at both Twitter and Facebook. And I'd love to friend and follow anyone who's interested. And there are links to buy my book, you know, Amazon and Book People and all the usual places, Audible and all that. All those links are on KristenCaseyAuthor.com. Also, there's a blog there where I add a bunch of new pictures. I've got 1,000 pictures, so I'm kind of slowly posting them on that blog. A lot of backstage stuff. So all the things that I write about, there was only room for 30 or 40 pictures in the book, so I've got another, 950.
Give me that website. Give me that blog or that website again, then, please, so we can check it out.
Yeah, you bet. It's Kristen, KristinCasey, Casey, author, AUTHOR.com. And there's links up top, and just click on the blog. I got 6 or 7 blog posts up right now, and I'll be adding some more pictures real soon, and some more stories. Some stories that didn't make it into the book, and some pictures as well.
Absolutely superb. We look forward to that. Kristen, it's been author of Rock Monster, My Life with Joe Walsh. It's been a pleasure and a privilege to speak to you. Have a great day today.
It's been wonderful. Thank you so much for having me. Take care.